Well, Sandy, Sandy's not here. Sandy raised a quote, raised a question last time about the butterfly. It's not directly related to our material, but I found a wonderful quote, which I thought I would just read you. You can keep it with your notes because it's superb. About the symbolism of the butterfly, just to get our juices going here.
Well, I can use this.
Yeah, it fits your painting as well. It's from one of my favorite books, H.G. Bain's Mythology of the Soul, which is a 1,000-page treatise on borderline psychotic. It's wonderful. It's out of print, unfortunately. It's one of those ones that's like $300 on eBay. But it's really, really wonderful. Jung loved Bain's. Jung and Bain's traveled to Africa together. Bain's was his traveling companion, and Bain's was a psychiatrist. So this is just what Bain said about the butterfly. We're just talking about you.
I got nowhere to move.
You can squeeze your hand if you want.
Okay.
This person
is
I was just following up on your butterfly question, Sandy. That's what we were starting with last time. You asked about the butterfly as a symbol of the psyche.
Oh, psyche, okay. Thank you, Nancy. You're very kind of you.
How did you pass that, Sandy?
Question.
No, I don't have any copies. Oh, I do have a copy. The butterfly is the classical symbol of the irrational, self-moving activity of the mind. And then I put the footnote in there. Besides meaning breath, life, and spirit, the word, that's the Greek, psuche. See, that's psi, and then u, x, and that m is an e, psuche, which is psyche. Psuche also means butterfly or moth. So psuche means breath, life, spirit, butterfly, and moth, which was considered an emblem of the immortal soul by reason of its passing through a kind of death in chrysalis form. So this is so much rich symbolism in this little paragraph. Because of its wavered, indirect, unpredictable zigzag flight, and the way it is apparently blown and tossed by the wind, it is easy to regard the butterfly as an aimless gadabout, the sport of every fitful breeze. Nothing, of course, could be further from the truth, so far as the butterfly is concerned. If a human being behaved in that fashion, he would be what he supposes the butterfly to be. But in fact, the butterfly's unpredictable flight is his one safeguard against a host of predatory enemies. It could be said with equal truth that nature achieves her ends in the human sphere by the unpredictable motivations of the unconscious, which are able to elude the grasp of the most rational and predatory consciousness. So if you ever get, also if you get frustrated with how circular this writing is, you see, that's the nature of the psyche, is to be elusive. And we try to capture it, but we try not to capture it with a predatory mind that pins it down. Passes around too. And I went back and thought about our last class. I think our current section is so very, very important. And her presentation of a kind of zigzag, speaking of zigzags, zigzags all over the place, that I wanted to go back and review what we did last time with a little bit more care than we usually did, so we really get straight what her point is. Why I think it's so important is we hear all the time about Jung's understanding that the task of our time is the transformation of the God image. And that can so easily just be a group of words. And what we have in this book is an actual image of that. So rather than just give that as a sentence, I really wanted to give you the chance to experience what that image looks like and why she says that. So you at least have one example in your mind that you can explain to yourself or even explain to somebody else if necessary why Jung says this stuff. So I thought we'd go back over her argument and just make sure we really understand this image of the house. But before we get there, let's just do a quick general review of the last class. And to remind ourselves, what we've done so far is we've looked at basically four basic images in the four first parables: the darkness, the flood, the prison, and the Holy Spirit. That's there in the first two lines. So we're now at the fifth parable. In this chapter, we are beginning. But there are some typos in here. We are beginning attempts at healing on the part... No, that's right. In this chapter, are beginning attempts at healing on the part of the unconscious. And the first image we're going to see and focus on is this house image. Something else I mentioned that I want to reiterate is that we'll be seeing another layer come on the scene, and that is the three stages of the conjunctio, which I'll talk about today. So we will not only be looking at the various images, but we're looking at how they start to fit into a suprastructure, another paradigm. So we'll be doing two things from now to the end. The first big idea we talked about last time, which really isn't the specifics of it, I don't think are all that important for our level of understanding, and that is that the integration of the self occurs in four levels. Remember the four triangles, four tetrahedrons. I don't think you need to know all that symbolism, but if you can remember that there are levels of self-symbolism, then I think you've gotten the main point. And so that the self-symbols are basically multiples of four, and those four can be anything. Four things, four people, four animals, four plants, four divine figures. And it is important what the nature of that thing is that you have four of. So if you've got four stones, it doesn't mean the same as if you have four plants, doesn't mean the same as if you have four angels, four buildings, and so on. Basically, you can think of a gradation from the material to the spiritual, but also remembering that it's a spiral. And depending on what part of you needs to be consolidated, you will have an image of the appropriate level. If your hang-up is material world, if you're too soft and spongy, you may have a dream of four rocks. If you're out of touch with your own body, let's say, you may have a dream of four plants, of the natural. If you're out of touch with your emotions, you may have a dream of four animals, because the animals would represent the extensive side of your emotions. If you're materialist, you may have a dream of four angels, because the your self-task at the moment is the spiritual. So just so you remember that it can occur in any one of a variety of forms. Actually, it's a spiral, but for the moment, you know, in the phase you're in, it's going to show up as one particular version of four. That's the point. Why it's relevant to Aurora is because we're starting from the instincts and moving up to the spirit. Do we have any more of these? Now, what I thought I would do is I would actually summarize what she's saying and then try to show you how she got there. And last time we did it the other way around, I thought it might help if we look at what's the main point of this chapter. So that's what I put next. In discussing the house images, she introduces a very important point. Her first point is that this house of wisdom that's being built in the fifth parable is connected with the house of God. So she's going to amplify from the Bible to the phrases in the text which indicate that from his unconscious this house is being seen not just as connected with wisdom but connected with the image of God. That's the first thing she tries to substantiate. The next thing she tries to substantiate is that the image of God represented in this house is an evolution of the biblical portrait of God. So the way God shows up here is going to be different than the way we dogmatically or biblically think of it, and I will walk you through that, but just so you got the two main ideas. Now, if I can put a little parenthesis before we actually follow that logic. She makes so much reference to the book of Revelation in the Aurora text that I thought it might be worthwhile just taking a moment to summarize the book. So you kind of get in your mind what the story of the book of Revelation is so that when you see the various themes in Aurora, you kind of know where they fit into the book of Revelation and what significance they carry. Some of this is not important, some is. So in Revelation, in the first chapter, John is on Patmos, the Greek island. He has a vision of the apocalyptic Christ, and he's instructed to write the seven churches. He writes the seven churches with Christ's dictated message. Now, that's not so relevant, but this next part is disappear. Then he has a vision of the throne of God and Christ as a lamb. But where the lamb in the previous books of the Bible is this benign, passive victim, he's not so in the book of Revelation. He's feisty. So that, Jung felt, was very important, that there was a compensation to that, to this, I guess you would say, to the synoptic. Do you know what I mean by synoptic? Matthew, Mark, Luke?
Yeah.
John, it's just the first three, right?
First three, yeah. Because it's debated. Did the same John who wrote John write the book of Revelation? And I'm not enough of a biblical scholar to give the arguments for and against there. But in any case, that's also not that relevant. But just so you realize that in the vision of the end of time, John has this image of the Lamb as Jesus appearing to him. Then he has a vision of a scroll with seven seals in the hand of the one on the throne. So the one on the throne would probably be Yahweh or God. Not so important. An angel marks the forehead of the servants of God, for the rest of the world is destroyed. Not so important for our purposes. A vision of God, seven angels, seven trumpets, each sounding, singling destruction, eating the scroll of another angel. Temple is measured as instructed by an angel. Now, something that does come up. In this process, John has a vision of a woman who is clothed with the radiance of the sun, with her feet on the moon. She's called the Sun Moon Woman. And she's pregnant. And she gives birth. And there's a dragon waiting to devour the child. And the child is whisked up to heaven to protect it from the devouring of the dragon. And then he sees Satan fall from heaven. Then he has a vision of the enthroned Lamb and the angels of judgment, the same Lamb. Vision of seven angels with seven bowls of wrath, each bowl producing a plague. Not so important for our purposes. The seven angels shows John the whore of Babylon. Not so important for our purposes. He sees the last judgment. And now something that is important. At the end of the book, he sees Jerusalem, a heavenly Jerusalem, descending. And it's all made up of jewels and precious metals. And that Jerusalem will be the bride of the Lamb. There should be a space there before she develops. So, now, to go back to our text and just give ourselves a little time to make sure we understand why she is saying what she's saying. In the passage from Aurora on 3:17 at the bottom, "Oh, how blessed are they that dwell in this house, for therein everyone that asketh receiveth." She takes out of that image of receiveth the fact that it's a treasure house. It's got bounty to share. And then, again, jumping around, which is why things are so confusing, but still developing the same idea on page 331. "To the aura, quote, quote, "But the beauty of this house cannot be told. Its walls and streets are of the purest gold, and its gates gleam with pearls and precious stones." So that's straight out of the book of Revelation describing the New Jerusalem.
Yes, with that quote that, "Oh, how blessed are they," or whatever, that's from Revelation 2.
Where's that?
The one you just said, "For wisdom standeth at the door, behold, I stand at the gate and knock."
3:17.
Yeah, right. Oh, it is, huh?
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Yeah, we do get there.
Except they have it as Christ, you know, the lamp.
But later, I think, I don't want to get confused here in my order, because it's so darn complicated. Hang on to that. I think she... Yeah, that's referred to Christ, right? Okay, yeah, we're on track then. So, this house of wisdom is likened to the New Jerusalem, which at the end of time is connected with Christ as an enlargement of the Christ image. Because Christ now has a bride. So, before you had one, there you have two. She's just beginning to lay an argument that that house of wisdom is, in its descriptions, linked up with imagery that is ascribed to the God. You follow her thought process. The language used to describe the house is the same language used to describe some aspect of God, Christ, or God, or God's wife in the Bible. So she's showing the biblical associations to that image tie it to God. Then, what Carol was saying, "Behold, I stand at the gate and knock." So that gate, remember, is in this house. And then over on 3:18, she refers to John 10:9, where Christ is equated with the door. So again, we have that aspects of this house are described not as being purely related to Sophia, but related to Christ and to God. Fourth, this is where we got a little confused. A third point on page 3:19. See if I can pull this off. People are in this house who first can't see, but then, thanks to wisdom, they can see. So that's, "I have not seen nor ear heard." Then in the next passage on page 3:19, that little short quote, "So that face to face, night and eye, they shall look." So, thanks to wisdom, they do get to see. Now, that she sees as a reference to 1 Corinthians 2:9, that eyes don't see and ears don't hear what? The things that God has created. So, again, the reference of the object of sight and hearing, alluded to by the wording, is God. So even though the house is the house of wisdom, the textual references to it are all taken from references to Christ and God in the New Testament. And the other reason she mentions is page 3:19. "So the face-to-face night and day, they shall look." And that "they" is a reference, is explained on page 3:27, as the elders, 24 elders, nothing to do with blackbirds, or pies, and that is a reference to those who bow down to the Lamb, There are 24 elders that bow down to the Lamb in the book of Revelation. So the 24 elders here are looking at something. And what is they looking at? Well, if we take the textual reference as a comparison, what they're looking at is the Lamb or some aspect of Christ. So four times we've got phrases from the Bible that refer as the object of their description to God or Christ. But in the text they are to be characteristics of this house. Now remember, we're taking this as a vision. So he's not thinking this stuff up. He's delirious and it's coming out of his mouth. So his unconscious is equating this house to the image of God. That's the first point. Is that clearer? I think it's so convoluted, but I've tried to make it linear.
If it's his unconscious, then that's coming from the self.
Right.
Okay.
So that in his unconscious, you see, there is a tendency to reframe an understanding of God. And that might not be so important if it were some bum in a bar somewhere, but this is Thomas Aquinas. So that a central figure in the church who has committedly devoted himself to the prevailing image of God is being shown the next image of God. Probably because he was so devoted to the prevailing image of God. Now, the next part is that what is described in that house, which we are thinking is going to be God, is the sun and the moon. So the text is saying the sun and the moon are images of God. That's the chain of associations. Texts establish that the house is a house of God, and then we see what is in the house of God and is an image of the sun and the moon. That's on page 319. That's repeated on page 327, because what they see are the brightness of the sun and the moon. Now, I think this next piece is so interesting, I almost can't stand it. But then I'm strange. Let's read it together. That's 320. So, on 319, she's been making the point that the sun and the moon and the light from the sun and the moon are in that house. So let's pick up on 320. Now she's saying that's an allusion to Apocalypse 21. And the city had no need of the sun, neither of the moon. So let's just stop right there. Well, to shine in it. English go a little bit. For the glory of God did lighten it. So in the Apocalypse, we are specifically told they didn't need the sun and the moon because the light of God shone in its place in heavenly Jerusalem. Now just stop for a minute and interpret that historically. What's that mean? In the old days, 2,000 years ago, what would the sun and the moon have signified?
The pagan element?
Yeah, the gods of classical mythology. Mm-hmm. So, and again, if you have to take this as a metaphor for the historical development of the god image, which is a You cannot reduce this to anything. This is simply a psychological fact. It's the fundamental ground of the Western psyche being shown us here. That at first, the light by which people understood the world was determined by classical mythology. And then there was a valid shift where a new understanding occurred, and that's called Christianity. And that understanding took the place of the old understanding. You know, you can think of that practically, that the hedonism of the of antiquity was simply surpassed by a new mode of understanding, and that's a miracle. How did that happen? It just happened. That's Jung's position. So it's a very important development in that the psychological meaning of that phrase is very important historically. Now we go on. For the glory of God did lighten it, and the Lamb is the light thereof, blah, blah. And the nations of them which are saved shall walk in the light of it. And so on. And now I go to the next sentence. In the apocalypse, therefore, the place of the sun and the moon is taken by the supernatural light, the Lamb of God. That's what we just said. Okay. Now skip down a couple of sentences. But whereas, this is why I think it's so important. But whereas in the apocalypse, the light of God, that's the id. But whereas in the apocalypse, the light of God takes the place of the sun and the moon. Here it is begotten by the sun and the moon in accordance with the classical alchemical formula that the lapis arises between the sun and the moon is mentioned in the earliest Greek text. So you see, we've gone from an image of God that was whereby understanding came from the sun and the moon to an image of God where understanding came from another dimension, whatever God represents. But now understanding comes again in a different form. However, this time it is not the light of the sun and the moon. It is a light begotten from the sun and the moon. See, it is not a return to pagan symbolism. Isn't that amazing? Can you see how exciting that is? You really see the whole shift in consciousness that we are now struggling with portrayed in that image. It is not going back. The text does not say it's just, by implication, it doesn't say it's just the light of the sun and the moon. Because of the alchemical background of this text, when sun and moon comes, it's not the light of the sun and the moon. It's the light of the sun and the moon as constituents for a new light. That's why I think it's so amazing. So that our psychological task is to incarnate God. That's what Jung is saying, that we can't just look at light from the hedonistic instinctual basis of classicism, beautiful as it is. We cannot, if you are at all in touch with the historical process, no longer look at light from look at your light from the strictly in the light of the strictly Christian standpoint. What you have to do is create your own light by the synthesis of your own sun and moon. And that new light is another dimension of the experience of God which you are creating. So there's light in all three cases, but the light changes. And our time now is to make, I can't say make our own light, but use our fragmentation as the basis of our own experience of the sacred. That's what she's trying to get at, I think. That's why this is so important.
And Gary, it's interesting too, though, that you know, the moon goddess is Artemis.
Yeah.
It's wild nature.
Yeah.
And the sun god is Apollo.
Right.
So, I mean, even if you just take away those ideas of the divinities and think about them as their energy.
Right.
I mean, that's amazing.
It's amazing, yeah.
Amazing.
That's what we have to synthesize.
That whole idea, because Artemis is untamed nature. She's just wild nature. And Apollo, of course, is the thinking, thoughtful. So it's like the marriage of the logo and what's the word, in wisdom, the word in wisdom.
You lost me there.
I don't mean wisdom. I mean instinct. Because she's instinctual.
Artemis.
Yes.
Yeah.
Artemis is right.
Right. And Apollo is...
He's the sun god. He's the thinking...
He's the sun god.
Right. So he's the more rational, and she's the instinctual.
That was the symbolism of the moon landing, when Apollo and Artemis came together and gave us a vision of the whole Earth.
I never thought about that.
Mm-hmm.
What?
Wow.
Apollo was the mission to the moon.
Yeah.
It landed on Artemis, the moon. And so Apollo and Artemis came together and gave us a vision of the whole Earth.
I think twins, Artemis and Apollo, the references here. Mm-hmm. So they originally come from the same place too, kind of.
Yeah. And Artemis is Diana in Rome, and it was in her temple that Mary was named Theotica.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it just all...
Mm-hmm. You can feel we're into something here, onto something here.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And poor Thomas was wrestling with this stuff in 1320, whatever it was. And you can see how why people say, oh, Jung's just psychologizing religion, blah blah. But he's trying. This is what he's struck by, that there is a new appearance of God trying to come through, but it's something that has to be the result of our efforts. So you can't just have religion without psychology. Or psychology, I even hate using the word, without an internal struggle out of which you create the entry for a new illumination. Your work, your efforts are so important, so you can almost say, I do it, but you don't quite do it. You do the work that sets the stage for it. And that's the religious test.
And if you think about mythology, it all springs from the human imagination. It's just that it's some human imagination, and so now what we're being called to is the individual participation in that.
And even creation of that.
Which is an unfolding of what is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Does co-creation of God fit in there?
I think this is very similar.
Yeah.
How is this, or does it, a lot of it is, you know, the moon is basically, the light in the moon is just with the reflection of the sun. And one of the stories I remember being told was that the Mary at some point was saddened because of the fact that the earth was darkened, and that's why the moon was put there, so that in our darkness, in our dark times, on that inner journey, there would be the light. You see, we didn't look at it as inward, but so, in a sense here, it seems like we've looked at the sun and the moon, and what this is really doing in some way that's playing in my head right now is that we're not really supposed to look outside at all, at one place or the other. We aren't just a reflection, we are it.
Yeah, I think mythologically speaking, as far as the unconscious is concerned, the moon is a luminary in her own right.
Mm-hmm.
It does, as far as I have seen in dreams, you don't get this idea that the moon is just a reflector of light, that it's its own source. And I would say then what we are wrestling with then is that we try to synthesize our own masculine and feminine sides. The light in our own masculine and feminine sides is to give birth to itself a new light, a new understanding. I think that's where we are today. Um, you know, I've been fascinated with the matriarchal cults very much, and but I have to also say that they aren't the light. See, they're the moon. And it's not just a matter of going back and getting the moonlight. It's getting the moonlight and the sunlight and then synthesizing them to the birth of a third light. That's where we left off. 320.
You know, it's really interesting. This book is so heavy, I couldn't take it with me. It was gone.
Heavy in many ways.
But I just answered a joke.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting how, you know, I mean, I feel like I'm really right in tune with everything.
The answer to Job is very similar.
Right. I was surprised.
In a funny sort of way.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting, you know, just kind of.
I think the similarity, one of the similarities between the two, is that both of them emphasize the importance of the ego. Here the ego is required to get the light born of the sun and moon. And Job, ego is responsible for not being manipulated by the dark side of God. Very important.
And the inner struggle it takes to birth.
And the enormous inner struggle, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, maybe I shouldn't say this, but I will say it anyway. I was talking to a person about a certain speaker that's coming here talking about religion and psychology. And apparently in the book, this author wrote that we should have little societies where people get together and help each other support their numinous experience. But can I tell you my story about the little old lady in the church in France? Can I tell you that? You heard it, Sandy. Did I tell you? No? So I was in France last summer. A friend of mine knows the area very well. And we found, she knows of a knows of a little, about a 13th century chapel in this little itty-bitty town. And so we went there at noon, and which is, you don't do that, you know. You don't, people either eat or make love from 12 to 2 in France. But we were brave, and she knocked on the door, and the woman was making love. She was cooking, thank goodness. And she was maybe 80 or so, very small, diminutive, and my friend asked if we could, she was the sexton of the church, we found out, if she could show us the crypt. There's a crypt at the bottom of the church. And she said, no, the lights are on the church, the fuse blew, and, you know, so you have to sort of humor people. So she charmed her and said, well, we have a friend here from America. We rode our bikes up. Well, she liked the fact that we were bikers. Mm-hmm. Well, okay, maybe she could show. So she got her big flashlight and she took us down to this crypt. And it was these beautiful 12th century frescoes, 13th century frescoes. And this little crypt, about half the size of this room, you couldn't even stand up, dirt floor, childish in their execution, but moving in their vitality. And she had a flashlight, she showed us. Well, it was just so moving. We were just going, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And she felt that, you know, we were very appreciative. And so she warmed up the more she realized that we knew what her little parish had. So afterwards she said, I got this in translation, my French isn't good enough. She goes, Monsieur Dom, you really like this, don't you? I said, okay, yeah. So she turned off the light. She stood there for about 5 minutes in silence. She said, you know, if you come here and you sit in the darkness long enough, these figures in the wall, they come alive and they give you things. See, she was living that numinous religious experience. And so I said to this person who was telling me about forming little groups, now could you imagine telling her to go to a little group to develop her numinous experience? That what I think I'm getting out of this text and what she told me is that the here it's the struggle, and with her it was the darkness. But that's the key to finding this new relationship to God. And it's really what Jung calls individuation, that you find your own path, you find your work on the inside, and a little bit to what you were saying, Marilyn, a slight shift, it is not different from your work on the outside. You, when you get deep enough, you find they are the exact same thing. The inner work and the outer work is the same thing. By giving to the outer world, you're developing your inner world, and when you develop your inner world, you're contributing to the outer world. And it's that struggle and the darkness that comes as you try to find your way in that struggle that is the birth of this light. And it's such an individual challenge, and it's not a challenge that you can do separate, but it's the way you live in the world, so that the world itself becomes a vehicle for your synthesis of these opposites and for your discovery of this new life. I think that's the task of our time. Jung gave it a big word, individuation, and it's so easy to throw around and not mean anything, but that's to me one of the things it means. The struggle that it takes to bring this new illumination, which is a synthesis, to bear.
You know what I love, Gary, too, in the Arthurian legend, when the knights go off to find the Grail?
Yeah.
They only enter the forest at the darkest point where there's no path. Hmm. They don't go in a group. So think about how old, that's over 1,000 years old, and that's how they got up from the table, mm-hmm. and they were not to follow a path, and they were not to go in groups, they
yeah.
in pairs. Each of them had to go on their
just
own.
Just beautiful. Same idea.
And, yeah, just mm-hmm. amazing.
Yeah, I think the Grail and this are of the same well, very much so. Yeah, and probably too, I think you could even say the tradition of courtly love. It's at its deepest level. It's based on this. Yeah, it's discovery of the feminine through the darkness. Really, they were battling, but it's the battle, it's the inner battle that we're now able to understand it to me. It's the same idea.
If you can
stand, yeah. Okay, you okay with that? Questions or? Oh, I know what I wanted to do. If you're okay with that, no. I thought I'd read you a couple of Jung's sun moon visions, just so you hear what it's like. Try to put some flesh onto this stuff. Let me see. You know, he had that heart attack in 1944. He was 69. And what I'm going to read you are, he has quite a few, it's in the chapter of visions in memories. He quotes quite a few visions. I've just picked a couple out. But again, if you can think, the reason I'm doing this is to give you an example of uniting the sun and the moon. Where would you see the light that has come out of uniting the sun and the moon in Jung? Well, that near-death experience and these visions of union, which is what I'll be reading you, presaged all his later works. So I would say all his later works are that light that came out of the union of the sun and the moon when he was nearly dead. So that what this union of the sun and the moon and the production of the light actually looks like is a new burst of vitality and understanding and creativity, a new point of view. He brought forth the final version of his point of view, and I think probably even modified it in the sense of the importance he gave to synchronicity. And all that then, I would say, would be the light born of the sun and the moon in Jung's version. So this is Memories, I'll just read you a couple paragraphs. Memories 289. Let me find the right passage. At the beginning of 1944, I broke my foot, and this misadventure was followed by a heart attack. In a state of unconsciousness, I experienced deliriums and visions, which must have begun when I hung on the edge of death and was being given oxygen and camphor injections. The images were so tremendous that I myself concluded that I was close to death. My nurse afterward told me it was as if you were surrounded by a bright glow. That was a phenomenon she had sometimes observed in the dying, she added. I had reached the outermost limit, and I do not know whether I was in a dream or an ecstasy. At any rate, extremely strange things began to happen to me. Apropos Artemis and Apollo and the whole Earth. It seemed to me that I was high up in space. Far below, I saw the globe of the Earth. This is before we had those pictures. Bathed in a gloriously blue light. I saw the deep blue sea and the continents. Far below my feet lay Ceylon, and so on. I must be getting dyslexic. I'm putting my numbers backwards. Everything around seemed enchanted. At this hour of the night, the nurse brought me some food she had warmed, for only then was I able to take any and ate with appetite. For a time, it seemed to me that she was an old Jewish woman, much older than she actually was, and that she was preparing a ritual kosher. She was preparing ritual kosher dishes for me. When I looked at her, she seemed to have a blue halo around her head. I myself was, so it seemed, in the Pardes Rimonium, the garden of the pomegranates, and the wedding at Tifereth and Malkuth was taking place. So Tifereth and Malkuth are two of the masculine and feminine side of the divinity in the Kabbalah. So he was seeing that. Could be. Malkuth. Well, what did I say? Whatever it is. Tifereth and Malkuth was taking place. Or else I was Rabbi Simon ben Jochai, whose wedding in the afterlife was being celebrated. It was the mystical marriage. It was the mystic marriage as it appears in the Kabbalistic tradition. I cannot tell you how wonderful it was. I could only think continually. Now this is the Garden of the Pomegranates. Now this is the marriage of Malkuth with Tifereth. I do not know exactly what part I played in it. At bottom, it was I myself. I was the marriage, and my beatitude was that of a blissful wedding. So that's
number
294. That's what it looks like in an individual. So then after that came his major authorship, which I would understand to be the light that was born out of that.
That whole earth idea is reflected in our next chapter, I think, where it says that the earth is the mother of the four elements, mm-hmm. or wholeness. Mm-hmm. So that whole idea fits together, looking back at a whole earth.
Right.
I have a question back. You say the discovery of the feminine is through the darkness, but then we talk about the light is to give birth to a new light. The moon and the sun synthesize to the birth of a third light. So are we looking for the answer in the darkness, or are we trying to see... to create the new light?
I'd say to do our part in the creation of the new light by enduring the darkness.
Enduring the darkness. Mm-hmm. We don't need to go back and look at it.
Well, sure. When I say enduring, I mean not avoiding it.
But,
not
but,
feeling it.
But finding more what is in it, maybe?
Yeah, or I guess I see it as a portal. Darkness. I see darkness as a portal.
But a discovery of the feminine through the darkness, so you're going to go through the darkness portal to find the feminine?
Well, the darkness is the portal. And it will come to you. If, when I say feminine, I probably I'm not being very careful with my language. To find the light that comes out of the union of the masculine and the feminine. Now, given our consciousness is so masculine dominated, when I say feminine, I mean the feminine aspect of that union. Because it will reevaluate our control, our need to control. Doesn't make sense.
I've just finished reading that Conscious Femininity by Marion Woodman, mm-hmm. and she talks about the feminine, but not in the way I had been used to. And she talks about it as being not necessarily the way before Christianity, that was more of a mother thing,
mm-hmm.
but that we have never actually had a feminine conscious
right.
on Earth. And this new thing we're striving for, this Sophia, this
thing we're going to is going to be a new kind of consciousness mm-hmm. that is not patriarchal and mm-hmm. it's not...
Not matriarchal either.
It's going to be more of the true...
That's what I would call the light in between here, the third light. Mm-hmm. Yeah, now see, that's old stuff mm-hmm. that she wrote here. I think if she would talk to her today, she would say that that feminine is going to be one pole of a union. But it, to the extent that we're so masculine dominated, we have to develop the feminine so it can unite with the masculine. Uh-huh. And I think that's where she's coming from. But if you hear her talk today, I think you'll find it's a slightly different message.
My question is delving from, it seems like I'm running into darkness.
Join the club.
Well, I'm finding it in my dreams.
Yeah.
It's behind me. It's in front of me. Things are popping off pages in the Marian Woodland thing. She's talking about that Vietnam wall
yeah.
as being black mm-hmm. and coming out of the earth and low and touchable kind of thing. And it just seems like black and darkness and Black Madonna and, mm-hmm. you know, things like
that's
that.
That's where we have to be today.
This isn't easy.
It's not easy. But you see, to me, one of the contributions of Jung is that he showed us many, many times, I think particularly of that essay in, I think it's in volume 91, Archetypes in the Collective Unconscious. It was a series of paintings of mandalas. Do you have to remember that? There he shows how in those mandalas, the light is born in the mandala when it's the darkest. That's the idea. That we're not just masochists, we're not just trying to get people depressed, we're not just trying to ruin your day, we're just trying to say, don't stop running away, Western civilization, from the darkness which is there. Because it doesn't have to be your enemy, it can be the source of new experience for you.
My question though is, if you have a choice there, and you're like I had a dream where I'm coming out of a doorway, and behind me is darkness, and at the end is light, and I naturally wanted to gravitate toward the light, but now I'm beginning to think, should I have gone to see?
Yeah, maybe you've gone through the darkness already.
Okay.
Who knows? And it also goes in spirals.
I just, you know, it just seems to me like I want to know if I'm going to meditate, or if I'm going to have active dialogue, or if I'm going to, you know, do some work, period.
Mm-hmm.
Should I look to see if there is anything in that darkness that I need to work with?
Well, just the dream you told me about, which any one of us could have, I would say if it's saying you're coming out of the darkness and you're moving to the light, then your task at this moment isn't the darkness.
Okay.
It may not for you at this moment. Now, in 2 years, you may get back into that darkness again, but it goes in a cycle.
Oh, gosh, yes. You know, it's interesting because we're talking about those kind of things, and all of a sudden things start coming back to me from the 60s. Paintings that I did back in the 60s of... there was a painting, a watercolor I did, and I could not think of what name I'd given to it. And just last night, I remembered it was the Black Widow. And, you know, I've been doing the Black Madonna.
Uh-huh.
I've been working with Sophia. It's interesting how the synchronicity of these things.
Speaking of black things jumping out at you, I remember when I was in, I worked for a year, God, I can't believe I did this, as an intern in the church, and... I had to do some preaching, and the last sermon I gave, the night before I gave it, I was in the dream, I was giving the sermon, looking at my manuscript, and I came to the end of a sentence, and I looked at the period, and it started growing, and growing. It turned into this big black hole, and started chasing me around the church.
No!
As I was running, like, no, go away! The darkness got me in Zurich, but I was able to avoid it until I got to Switzerland.
Karen, there's a Campbell's book called The Inner Reaches of Outer Space, Religion is Myth and Metaphor, is the book that has talked about science, but it's all myth, sun and moon myths. He talks about the larger that we can see the space outside of us, the more abundant we begin to find the space within us. And so he uses that metaphor of the land in which we may be thinking of.
It's very smart, yeah. But
for sun and moon, if you want myths on that, it's full of them.
Let's see. Well, should we take a stretch and then we'll pick up?